What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks. What's cracking, family? It is Monday, May 18, 2026. This is Law and Disorder. I am your host, Kat Brooks. On today's show, Palestine Post re-examined Israel's U.S.-backed assaults on Palestine, and we now include the region, turning our attention to Lebanon, Syria, and Iran, the people's resistance to the violence of colonialism and the impacts across the globe, material and economic. Our guest today is Phyllis Bennis, a Middle East analyst who directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's an author, educator, advocate, and activist, and she's going to join us to expose, agitate, and build. It has been 40 days since Israel and the United States launched their illegal war on Iran. In that time, an estimated 6,500 to over 9,000 people have died across the Middle East since they began their military campaigns and retaliatory strikes. Total casualties vary by nation and reporting agencies, but in Iran, between 3,500 and 6,000 people have been killed, according to figures from Iran's Ministry of Health and U.S.-Israeli tracking sources. In Lebanon, nearly 1,500 to 2,800 people have died amid Israeli airstrikes and border clashes. In Iraq, at least 119 people have been killed, and approximately 13 U.S. service members have died, primarily in operational accidents and hostile actions. And in Palestine, official records indicate over 73,000 Palestinians have been murdered. The Gaza death toll has reached that since October 7, 2023. More than 170,000 people have been wounded, missing. Thousands more are presumed dead, missing, buried under collapsed building and debris. Those are just the numbers we know about, and I say them every Monday because we have to keep in mind the human contact, right? It's not just these children playing war games that are being impacted. Lives are being lost. Joining us to discuss this and more is Phyllis Bennis, a Middle East analyst who directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's the author of Understanding Palestine and Israel and several other books. Good morning, Phyllis.
Good morning, Kat. Good to be with you.
Good to have you back. I want to kick off actually with a clip from the Orange Dude about his supposed military victory in Iran. Kirsten, can we roll that clip, please?
Bombing you did it for 38 days.
Well, no, we did,
and you did not get the political changes in Iran.
No, I had a total military victory, but the fake news guys like you write incorrectly. You're a fake guy, and guys like you write about it incorrectly. We had a total military victory. We've had a total victory, except by people like you that don't write the truth. You know, you should write. I actually think it's sort of treasonous what you write, but. You and the New York Times and CNN, I would say, are the worst.
I read it. I knew what it was going to say, so I don't know why I'm sitting here shell-shocked with my mouth shut. Because the next series of questions I have for you, Phyllis, is about ongoing negotiations. So that's bananas. And I guess I just go, I guess why I started with that is because it's like, where do we go from there?
Yeah. You know, this isn't entirely a new phenomenon in this country. If we look back to Vietnam, we heard over and over again, we're winning every battle. And more or less that was true. If you looked at each battle separately on every hillside, the U.S. troops, who enormously outnumbered Vietnamese troops, enormously more and better and more powerful weapons, they won every victory. They won every victory in every battle, and they lost the war. So, you know, here we're hearing from Trump on a daily basis that two simultaneous things are true, that on the one hand, we have won. We've already won. We've had a military victory. Iran's nuclear capacity has been destroyed. It's been completely outlawed. It's been destroyed. And we have to maybe consider going back to war to make sure that Iran cannot have a nuclear policy. Cannot have a nuclear program. It's as if those two things are not in contradiction. You know, if they had been destroyed, if something had been destroyed, why are you going to war to destroy it, right? So this sort of asking people to believe the unbelievable is an old story. But I think that what we're actually looking at here certainly the continuation of genocide in Gaza, the continuation of war in Iran, and we are looking at the continuation, ironically enough, of a kind of diplomacy. Just this morning, there was a new response from Iran via Pakistan, who's acting as the current negotiator, to Washington's latest proposal. They've gone back and forth on this. So there are some negotiations going on. What we don't know is how serious they are and how much the US is actually trying to avoid going back to war with all of the incredible human costs that this war has imposed on human lives across the region, on the economy of this country, particularly among the poorest sectors of this country, and of people around the world who are suffering economically, but increasingly at the human level in terms of food shortages, water shortages, all these things that are affected by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. So all of this is going on while this so-called negotiations are underway. You have the discussions going on at the United Nations, which is not going anywhere because it's in such an incredibly one-sided approach. So all of these things are going on while we're expected to simply forget what we know, in this case, for about Iran, that Iran has long ago not only ended whatever moves it had made ending in 2003, more than 20 years ago, the possibility of ever creating a nuclear weapon, but have explicitly, at both the level of the religious leadership and the political leadership in Iran, have said that they don't have a nuclear weapon, they're not trying to build a nuclear weapon, and that building, obtaining, having, or God forbid, using a nuclear weapon would be in complete violation of Islamic law. You also have, and this is something I think they expect us to forget about as well, as recently as last October, October of 2025, just 2, 3 months before the US and Israel launched these attacks on Iran that came to fruition in June of last year, and now again, of course, in this full-scale war. What we saw from the US intelligence agencies, all 16 of them, in their annual threat assessment, which requires agreement by all the US intelligence agencies, they said explicitly Iran does not have a nuclear weapon, is not building a nuclear weapon, and that the leadership in Iran has not changed its long-standing decision not to build a nuclear weapon. And yet, we're expected to believe that there's something legitimate about the US going to war against Iran to stop them from doing something they have pledged not to do, and that the US intelligence people, if you want to use that term, agree they are not doing, right? All around the world, the UN inspectors, every country in the world, with the exception of Israel, have agreed that the Iranians are not building a nuclear weapon, cannot build a nuclear weapon. And yet, we are hearing that that's the reason we have to go to war. So it's a question of how do we understand history? What do we forget about history as we're being told a new history and expected to believe it?
I want to ask you regarding that. So all of that stuff that you just said that would make even his base cock their heads to the right and say, well, then what's happening, right? Then why are we sending all of this money and military to the region? A, if we've already run one, B, if it's not a threat. Trump engaged as he has, across both terms, with that media, with that reporter calling him fake news and a liar. But he mentioned like CNN and the New York Times, who, I'm sorry, I wouldn't necessarily refer to them as truth tellers. I'm wondering about media complicity here, right? We talked a lot about it at the beginning of this iteration of the genocidal assault on Gaza by Israel, the repetition of lies by the Zionist Project, which I won't repeat here. What do we see now? Any difference? Any change? Clearly, what Trump said isn't true, but they're not working against him. I don't see any media outlets talking about. Wait. There was this report, except for here. There was this report that said that actually they're not a nuclear threat.
Right. Well, they are certainly not doing those things. They are doing some things, I think, better. I think they have been shamed, and it's had an impact in their subscriptions. So I don't think they are completely immune to political pressure. And I think the movement of simultaneously supporting independent media like Pacifica, like like KPFA, like Democracy Now!, like all of these sources, and simultaneously keeping up the pressure on the mainstream media has had an impact. We've seen changes in how the media covers these wars. Is it good? No. Is it sufficient? Not even close. But is it way better than it was 5 years ago, 3 years ago, 10 years ago? Absolutely. So that's where we are, I think. The questions about why there is legitimacy for going to war against Iran, I think we have to go back to the Iranian Revolution of 1979, when the sudden explosion of Islamophobia and anti-Iranian racism in this country, with, I remember, t-shirts with pictures of Khomeini with a target on him that were popular on college campuses and in communities and in parks. You saw them in shopping centers, you saw them on the streets all over the place. That had an incredible impact on this country. The humiliation, if you will, had an enormous impact on officials in the State Department, other diplomatic arenas, because US diplomats had been kidnapped and held hostage for over a year. They were then released in very good shape. They had not been killed, they had not been shot. But it was a humiliation for the US that, in the context of this revolution that overthrew a long-standing US-backed dictatorship, that of the Shah of Iran, could somehow pull that off, right? That was hugely embarrassing for US officials. It led to all kinds of political consequences, including, among other things, the defeat of Jimmy Carter for a second term. There were lots of consequences of all of that. But one of the consequences was that anti-Iran racism and the sentiments of people across this country against Iran is very easy to recreate at a moment's notice, even when it begins to fade away, when it becomes clear, as in 2015. You don't have to look back only as far as 1979. Go back to 2015, when Iran and the US and five other, all the five permanent members of the UN that happened to be the five nuclear powers, and the European Union itself with Germany, all agreed on what was called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, which was the Iran nuclear deal, in which Iran agreed to give up the vast majority of its existing higher enriched uranium, to stop enriching uranium beyond what was required for medical and research purposes. And crucially, it agreed to accept a massively intrusive, unprecedented level of intrusion by UN and international inspectors to prove that they were continuing to abide by that agreement. In return, and this was crucial because this wasn't a one-way show, this meant that the US, who was negotiating with them, also had to give up something. What the US had to give up was agreement that the massive number of sanctions that the US had demanded, mainly imposed in the name of the United Nations, but because of US pressure, that those sanctions that were linked to Iran's alleged nuclear programs were lifted, and that money that had been frozen, that belonged to Iran, it was Iranian money, it was not US money, but it was frozen by the US in US and allied banks across Europe and elsewhere, that money had to be released and returned to Iran. So, in that context, you had this scenario where you saw that diplomacy, not war, was actually having the result that people said they wanted. They wanted Iran to stop its nuclear program. Well, it did. Now, it was clear they already had, but this made it official and it brought in these massively intrusive inspections. Everybody agreed that Iran was abiding by those agreements, by those regulations. They were not going back to nuclear, to higher levels of nuclear enrichment. And yet, in 2018, 3 years later, when Trump was in power, he shredded it. He just tore it up and said, "We don't like it anymore." He didn't even claim at the time that Iran was actually violating those regulations, what they had agreed to. Everybody agreed they were abiding by it. Trump just said, "I don't care. I can get a better one. I can get a better one with my deal making." Well, it turned out he couldn't. He couldn't get a better deal. And instead, he went to war. So we have this model that shows that only through diplomacy can you actually get Iran to do what you say you want it to do, change its practices, if the US is willing to change its practices and stop imposing the kind of crippling economic sanctions that are destroying lives of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people across Iran, that are holding back billions of dollars that belong to the Iranian people and allowing Iran to reclaim that money. When there's that kind of give and take, when there's that kind of negotiation, it's all possible. The irony is right now, we're not even negotiating over those things. We're negotiating over how to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, which for all of those years remained open. Iran was not closing it. They could have at any time. The Strait of Hormuz is in Iranian territorial waters. Under international law, they're supposed to let anybody who wants to use it. Under some circumstances, they can charge money to those ships. It's rather restricted, but that's not illegal. But they never claimed that right until now when the US and Israel went to war against them. Then they said, you know what? This is not okay. We're going to shut this down until we stop being bombed. Till we stop, it's been thousands of people who have been killed in Iran, over 100,000 homes destroyed, 300 medical centers destroyed. So, in that context, Iran said, you know what? This is not okay. We're going to shut down the Strait of Hormuz until we can figure this out. And that's what they're now negotiating over, something they never even had to worry about in the past when there were diplomatic efforts instead of war to persuade Iran.
I also want to talk a little bit about the negotiations, air quotes, that are happening through Pakistan between the United States and Iran. You mentioned that the proposals there was Iran just sent back their response via Pakistan to the United States, which includes the release of its assets frozen abroad, lifting of sanctions, compensation for war damage, and a USA blockade of the ports and a halt to fighting off fronts. Here's where I'm going with this, including Lebanon. Lebanon's going to be a sticking point.
And Palestine.
And Palestine. Yeah, we can get there in a second. Lebanon's sure going to be a sticking point. Israel is not going to stop bombing them until their Gazification is complete. I think we make that a real word in the dictionary because this is their mode of operandi. They're not going to stop till it's done. And I just don't think it's rational to expect the United States to do anything about it. And so I just wonder, I mean, I know there's a bunch of other banana stuff about the negotiations that are a problem. I'm worrying about Lebanon explicitly, and I guess explicitly like US Israeli complicity and Donald Trump's inability to rein in his homie.
Lebanon is certainly already paying a huge price for this war, and unfortunately, I think you're right, Kat, that that's likely to continue. There have been somewhere over in the area of 3,000 people. Nobody is sure because many of them have been killed and bodies are under the rubble, just like in Gaza. That's what Gazification includes. In Lebanon, 20% of the entire population of the country have been displaced. And keep in mind, Lebanon's a very small country. 25% of its population right now are refugees, mostly from Syria, and about 250,000 are from Palestine, who have now been displaced two or three or eight times, right, in the lifetime of every family. And once again, we're seeing not only displacement, but the inability to go home because their homes have now been destroyed. The level of destruction, 60,000 housing units in Lebanon have been seriously damaged or completely destroyed at this point. And there's no end in sight. As you say, there's no indication that the US is going to allow the current negotiations to include these broader issues that were on the table earlier. I have a feeling that the current negotiations are going to be limited to what's going to happen in the Strait of Hormuz. There is a report today, just a few hours ago, that Iran is negotiating with jointly with Oman, who shares the other side of the strait. The strait is made up of two sets of national waters, one the Omani waters and the other the Iranian waters. And they're coming together to figure out a joint position that they will then, I assume, try and negotiate with the US to make sure that the US stops its attacks on all Iranian ships and all ships that are either coming from or going to Iranian ports, regardless of what they're carrying. So if they're carrying crucially needed food, medicine, parts for civilian airplanes, parts for water purification, anything like that, the US is still stopping those ships. So the closure of the strait is not just about what Iran is doing, it's also what the US is doing. And it may be that the preliminary, or the first agreement that they get, that Pakistan is able to negotiate, will be solely on this question of what happens around the strait. That leaves Lebanon continuing, languishing under continuing Israeli bombing. Because, you know, Kat, what we're seeing here is not only sort of random bombing, we're seeing the Israeli claim of territory, claim of land. It is reoccupying right now virtually all of South Lebanon, and it has crossed the Litani River, the divide between South Lebanon and the rest of the country. Israeli troops are now on the border of the northern border of the Litani River, meaning they're in the rest of Lebanon, not only occupying South Lebanon, and claiming that this is going to go on until some undefined moment when, as the Israelis put it, our northern communities can live in peace. So they're claiming that this is some kind of a defense buffer, a buffer zone, by occupying other people's land. Exactly what they've done in the West Bank, in the creation of the apartheid wall, where the world kind of agrees on where is the so-called border between what is recognized by many countries, not all, as Israeli territory and what is recognized by the entire world as Palestinian territory in the West Bank. But they didn't build their wall on that border. They in building the wall, it was built within Israeli expanding Israeli territory on Palestinian territory, which lost about 15% of the West Bank by the creation of that wall, along with all six of the major water aquifers, which are now all on the Israeli side. So this notion of creating facts on the ground has now been reinterpreted quite creatively, if you look at it that way, of claiming land that belongs to other people and saying this is a buffer zone to keep us safe. It's what the Israelis are now doing in Gaza, what they claimed was the yellow line dividing what is now almost two-thirds of Gaza. It's about 65% of Gaza is now on one side of the so-called yellow line, and all the Palestinians have been pushed into the other side of this yellow line, which means that the people who were suffering in this incredibly crowded, one of the most crowded strips of land on the face of the earth, are now crowded into about a third of that tiny little strip of land, the same 2 million people that still have had their houses destroyed, their medical centers destroyed, schools destroyed. So that is what we're seeing in Gaza. We're seeing the beginnings of that in Lebanon as well. And so far, until there can be greater international pressure, I don't think we're going to see Iran necessarily demanding that Lebanon and Palestine be included in all of its agreements on how the war is going to end. I don't think we're going to see that from any other countries individually. It's going to take more unified efforts by the United Nations, by the international community as a whole. And that's a big challenge for civil society, for political movements, for the movement for Palestinian rights, for the flotilla, which has just this morning been attacked again in international waters, again, attacked by Israeli forces again. And as far as we know, at least 15 of the boats have now been boarded by Israeli military. We're assuming that, like the last time, that the people on board the boats from all over the country, many of them from the United States, we have not seen any effort yet by the State Department or members of Congress that we know of doing anything to protect those US citizens. Other countries are doing more to protect their citizens, but we are certainly seeing a willingness of the rest of the world so far to largely stand by with and not impose consequences on these Israeli assaults. And this is a huge challenge for international movements. We've seen it work before. We've seen it in the movement against South African apartheid.
No,
We
I was
can
going to
see
say
it
about that.
again here, but it takes concerted, unified campaigns all around the world to pressure their own governments to abide by the international laws that the resolutions that have been passed, for example, by the UN General Assembly, which are not binding in international law, but they provide a kind of basis for people in countries across the rest of the world to hold up as a tool and say, we are demanding that you abide, you, our government, you abide by these resolutions that say, for example, that there can be no recognition
Yeah.
of the Israeli presence in the West Bank, that all of the settlers must be evacuated. The deadline for that was last September.
Right.
September of 25 was the deadline. We didn't see a lot of settlers being evacuated. So all of these things can be done in other countries using those UN positions to pressure their own governments to impose these kinds of sanctions that are needed to hold Israel accountable and hold the United States accountable at the same time.
Even though I have so many other questions to ask you about Iran and the Strait and Lebanon, time is of the essence. I got about 10 minutes with you, so I do want to talk about Palestine. Let's do some more history lesson, Phyllis. May 15th was Nakba Day. What is the Nakba? And you can, if you'd like, segue, as you do so beautifully, into how Palestinians, we'll get to UK in a minute, but how Palestinians mark the day and the message that actually now is worse. That was considered the worst thing ever, but now is worse.
Thanks, Kat, and thanks for talking about the book in the context of this. I just want to add my urging for people to support KPFA, to support Pacifica, to support alternative understandings than what we get in the mainstream media. And that struggle for freedom and information is not free. We have to support it. So I hope everybody does. You know, Nakba Day, which is the, it's not, it's commemorated every year on May 15th. It's the day that Israelis celebrate as their Independence Day. And it's what Palestinians call they use the Arabic term Nakba, but it means catastrophe. And the reason that people sort of stick to that term was because that it wasn't only happening on that day, but in 1947, 48, that was the process of the dispossession and expulsion of over 750,000 Palestinians from their historic homelands. They were pushed out, some at the point of a gun, some by threats, but none voluntarily. Many went unwillingly, holding the keys to their home, which is why the key is now the symbol internationally of Palestinian right of return. People thought they would be coming home in 2 weeks, in 3 weeks after the fighting died down. Well, the fighting didn't die down for a long time, and the occupation continued. And those Palestinians, that generation, the Nakba generation, who are now in their 80s and 90s, that generation is mostly past already. Only a few are left. Their children have now taken that up, and their grandchildren and now great-grandchildren are the generations. The Zionist movement at the time said very publicly that this was going to be fine to expel people because the old people will die and the young will forget. Well, they were wrong. The young didn't forget. The young rebuilt that conversation, that understanding of where they come from. To this day, in refugee camps in the West Bank and Gaza, in Jordan, in Egypt, in Syria, and all around the world where Palestinians have resettled, many have become citizens wherever they're living. If you ask them, where are you from? And you ask a 20-year-old Palestinian college student in Milwaukee, where are you from? They will tell you the name of the village from which their grandparents were expelled or their great-grandparents were expelled. Or they might tell you the name of the refugee camp where their parents or grandparents were born and where they were first imagined, even though maybe they were born in Milwaukee. So that sense of connection has never been lost. And the notion of that as the catastrophe that shaped Palestinian life as the life of a refugee population, a population that has been dispersed throughout the world. There was never a sense that it could get worse. And yet, what we have seen is not just that the continuation of the Nakba, which was never a one-off event, it was a process which remained when Palestinians continued to be denied their right of return. That was the continuation of the Nakba. In 1967, when Israel occupied the last remaining 22% of historic Palestine, the West Bank and Gaza and occupied East Jerusalem. That was the next step of the Nakba at the collective basis. But at the individual basis, it has never ended. Those grandmas and grandpas still can't go home to their villages. And how that will play out in the next generations is very much on the minds of the people who are coming out to protest the genocide that now is the the description that is the most accurate for what is facing Palestinians in Gaza, and the apartheid and ethnic cleansing that is underway with such power across the West Bank, along with the Jim Crow style segregation of Palestinians who live inside the State of Israel. All of those things come together to mean the continuation of the Nakba. And it's in that context that I think we have to understand what is the role of the movement for Palestinian rights? What does it mean for how we examine the incredible shifts in public consciousness, in the public discourse, and in the media discourse? Again, as bad as the media is now in its coverage of Israel and its coverage of Palestine, if we compare it to what it was 2 years ago, 5 years ago, before October 7th, after the first Intifada, it is so much better because of the work of these movements that have demanded that change. That we now see, for example, 77% of Democrats, and I think it's in the low 60s of Republicans, now say no more aid to Israel. That's unimaginable. If I look back, I've been working on this issue a very long time, I hate to say. And if I look back to when I first started, in the late 70s and through the 80s, we never imagined we'd get there. It was, if we could get, 10% support, it was like, yay, we're doing great here. We have managed to transform that. The change within the Black community, when you had young Black kids growing up in the context of the Justice Generation that took shape so powerfully from 2014 when Mike Brown was killed in the streets of Ferguson, and then through till 2020 when we saw the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. In that process, you had a whole generation of young Black kids growing up into that movement, as we saw earlier generations growing up into the civil rights movement. And this movement, the Justice Generation movement, was one that was not only focused on police brutality and racism in this country, it was international as well. And there was a link to Palestine from the very beginning. If you look now in the last 2.5, 3 years, when Palestine has been very much at the moral center of the broad progressive movement in this country, again, you see these incredible changes. Young Jewish kids growing up into that movement saying, I don't want my Jewish identity to be bound up with supporting this government that's committing genocide. When I was a young Jewish kid growing up in California, we didn't have choices like that. If you grew up Jewish and you identified as Jewish, you supported Israel. That was that. It was there was no sort of debate about was that the appropriate position. Of course, in my temple, I was very involved in the youth group, all of that. We didn't really ever talk about religion. We didn't talk about God. We talked about Israel. That was what it meant to be Jewish. The culture, the education, and it wasn't only Jewish kids. In my high school, there were probably, I don't know, maybe 20% of the kids maybe were Jewish. Another 20, 25% were Black. The rest were kind of mixed up of everybody else. But in my classes, I can remember kids, all the kids wanted to write about Israel when they were told they had to pick a country that they were going to have to do a report about. And that was the country that we all knew more about than any other country. Because from kindergarten on, we had learned about it. The Jewish kids, of course, had learned more because we learned it also in Sunday school, but everybody learned about it. So I think that when we recognize the difficulty in what it has meant to change that politics, to change that political discourse, and how hard it is to go that final step, we've changed the public discourse, we've changed the media discourse. Changing the political decision making is now the challenge. It's really, really hard because that has been the dominant position, the fear of members of Congress that it's political suicide to criticize Israel. I'm not sure that was ever true, but it certainly isn't true now. And boy, did they not get the memo. Boy, are they out of touch.
We don't even have time to get into what's going to happen as we barrel towards, the midterms, and that combined with what just happened with the Voting Rights Act. My listeners know I'm going to do this, and I have to, because I'm accountable to families. We start often in Ferguson. I always nudge folks to remember, actually, this all kicked off in 2009 when Oakland exploded around Oscar. And even the founders of BLM will tell you that no struggle for justice for Oscar Grant, no Black Lives Matter, which got us, into Ferguson. So I don't have a lot of time. I got like 90 seconds with you, but Or and because you went there, I you know, and you connected. We do that a lot. Like I've got questions in my head, and then you just go there. You did connect, right? What's this struggle now to the fight for justice for the Black community? And before you said that, I was sitting there thinking, yes, you've worked on this issue a long time. I've worked on my issue for a long time, and sometimes I get really tired, or sometimes I'm like, and we're in this position now, you know, here in the United States, where things are actually getting we're going backwards, which happens all the time, white lash. So, like in just 60 seconds, what do you do in those moments?
Wow. It's really hard. This is a really hard time. But I think when I see how people coming out for, say, No Kings, I spoke at the No Kings rally in Los Angeles in whenever that was, a few weeks ago, March 28th. And I talked about Palestine and I talked about Iran. I talked about the war. And, you know, at the end, I talked about ICE, I talked about racism. And I got such incredible warm applause and excitement from a crowd of, I don't know how many thousands of people were there, but it was pretty big. You know, that was part of it. This wasn't just about racism and ICE. This was about everything. And everybody was part of that. And that's what we're seeing. You know, even when the leadership at some points of those protests didn't include Palestine in their calls, people said, it doesn't matter. We're bringing it anyway. We're going to wear our keffiyehs and bring our flags and bring our slogans that say, from Palestine to Mexico, all the walls have got to go, and get huge support for that. That we link the violence of ICE and what happens to immigrants here with what happens in Palestine. That we link police oppression in Black communities here with what happens inside Israel and in Palestine. All of these things are linked, and those linkages are becoming more and more real. So that when we end these chants with what I won't say on the radio because we really can't, but bad ICE and free Palestine, those two things come together. Those two things
Yes,
come
they
together. And
do.
that's why part of the reason that we need KPFA to keep bringing them together.
For the Spanish, I appreciate you. Thank you so much for joining us today. Talk
Thank
soon.
you.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.